Hello and welcome to the RTE Rugby Podcast. We're available on iTunes, Spotify and all the other places that you go for your listening. And I'd say you're doing quite a bit of it at the moment. But today on the podcast, we're going back to the year that kickstarted a rugby revolution. That was 2000 and a 44 points to 22 victory against Scotland at the old Lansdowne Road. Now, Scotland at that time, and this is going to come as a bit of a surprise to anyone born after 1990, hadn't been beaten by Ireland in no less than 12 years. Yes, Scotland, yes, 12 years. And since then, we all know Ireland have won slams, championships and triple crowns, not to mind long chunks of dominating European club rugby, all of which has combined to turbo boost the game's appeal and popularity to what it is, roughly speaking, today. Now, how rugby is consumed and by whom has changed massively. But that match meant that it went confidently into the era of celebrity with the likes of Horgan, O'Driscoll and O'Gara, amongst others, effortlessly becoming our first full-time, nationally recognised, domestically based professional sports stars. At the time, Donal Lennon was the Irish team manager and Wes Liddy was tearing it up at Tom Clifford Park. But we'll go to Donal first because he's marginally the more important in the scene. Because, yeah, a team manager, do we even have one now, Donal?
Well, it's certainly a totally different role now than I was back then. You go back, look, you're talking about, we were 5 years into the professional era when you're talking about 2000, but I think the IRFU, the whole thing took, it was very much a slow burner. I mean, I always make the point, fellas like Mick Galway and Peter Clahasy went to bed on one Saturday night in August 1995 as amateur players, and they woke up on the Sunday morning and somebody told them they were professional. I mean, I can guarantee you nothing changed. So it was definitely a slow burner. But yeah, look, I mean, at that stage, the management structure was three-man, the selection. I was manager of the side. Warren Gatland was coach, young coach who'd come in 2 years previous to this game and made a big impact and a huge difference. Brian Ashton had been appointed on a six-year contract. He was going to be the saviour of Irish rugby. He had done brilliant work with Bath. Bath were the dominant team in England at the time. He was an outstanding coach, a visionary coach who afterwards he brought England. People forget 2007, they made the World Cup final. Brian Ashton was coach of that England side. But I don't think Brian Ashton was ready for Ireland. Ireland certainly weren't ready for the revolution that he was bringing on board. So his six-year reign, I think, eventually lasted a year and a half, two Six Nations championships. But by the end of a second Six Nations in 1998, initially he went out on sick leave with shingles. Warren Gatland was brought in. I remember we were playing a game against France in Paris that we were expected to lose by a cricket score, and we ended up, I think we lost 18-16, and that was the start of the Gatland revolution. He was appointed Ireland coach after that game for a tour to South Africa, and I was appointed manager. So we came in together as a twosome in for that South African tour. Philip Danaher came on board as the assistant coach. So that was your selection committee.
And where was Eddie O'Sullivan at this stage?
Eddie, I'm not sure, was he with Connacht or where he was coaching? Eddie had been working with the RFU as development manager and in a number of different roles. In fact, he was our fitness coach when I was a player with them for the 1991 World Cup. He was assisting Kieran Fitzgerald. So Eddie had been in the background for a long time in a number of different roles. But Philip Danaher would have stepped down after the World Cup and that famous defeat in Lens. So Eddie came in at the start of the Six Nations Championship straight after the World Cup. So Eddie would have just come on board in the game prior to the Scotland match that we're going to discuss. And so he, both himself, Warren and I, would have picked the side, and we're very much running the show at that stage.
Yeah, Wes, come in now in a sec, but just for context, I mean, I showed my 21-year-old son the results from 96 when we went professional, 96 being the first Six Nations, until 99, the season before we're talking about. Now, he's not a massive rugby head, but he's a sports nut, and he couldn't get over 17 Six Nations games between 96 and 99. Ireland won four. Three against Wales and one, the inaugural one, against Italy. And I was showing him the beatings that Ireland were sustaining against not just France, which was familiar at that time, not just England, who were super professional before us, but against Scotland. And it's hard, you know, when we're, I suppose, when you've been around the block a bit longer, it's hard to cast back to the fact that the quality of results were abject. What do you think, Wes? 96 to 99?
Yeah, I suppose all through the 90s, it's a funny one to look back on this game because in some ways we look back at it now as the start of this current era. But really at the time, only 2 weeks earlier, we'd been slaughtered in Twickenham. And I suppose looking around the rest of the country at the time, hurling was kind of still at the tail end of this glory run of the 90s. I think it was the year that Maurice Fitzgerald kicked that point in Semple Stadium for Kerry against the Dubs. There was still a bit of a honeymoon from the Charlton era, maybe in soccer, coming to an end probably. But I suppose really rugby was completely in the doldrums in that period compared to other sports in the kind of, in the public consciousness. And I suppose a lot of the hardcore rugby fans, probably myself included, we're still probably lamenting the All-Ireland League starting to fall away a certain bit compared to in a matter of months after that game. We were all going to be very much on the Heineken Cup bandwagon, and obviously a lot of people in Ulster had been very much on that ship from the year before. But I suppose it's very tempting to say Ulster had gotten to the final the year before, Munster got to the Heineken final that year, O'Driscoll and O'Gara and all these guys came along, and this was very obviously the start of the professional era in reality in Ireland. But equally, it was a very fine margin between, some much darker times for Irish rugby as well. So to me anyway, it was certainly very much on a knife edge as to how it would go at that point. And I suppose what I'd be interested to hear from Donal is, was there a sense of inevitability after a few years of professionalism and with these young kids that things would inevitably improve? Or did you really have to dig in and work hard to earn these results and turn it around?
Well, I think you've got to put yourself back in that time. I mean, what happened was, as I said, rugby went professional in August of 95. Nobody really knew how to deal with it. I mean, I remember being involved in an Ireland selection committee, and we'd got a brief from the IRFU that we had to categorise players in three different categories, A, B and C. I think category A, they were the stars. They were getting, I think, 30,000 a year. Category B, the Mondeo came after that. I mean, that was a different story altogether. I mean, there was a period where each province, believe it or not, had only four professional players. So there was a kind of a scamper in each province to try and be one of the four. But the ridiculous nature of that meant that everybody else in the squad was amateur. So you couldn't train until 6 o'clock in the evening or early in the morning before players went to work. The next phase after that was the offer started coming in from England. The vast majority of the Irish players left en masse to go to London Irish, to go to Harlequins, to go to Bristol, to go to Leicester. So we had a scenario. Remember there was one Irish team. I have the programme somewhere. I remember being disgusted about it at the time because of the 15 players. In those days, the clubs used to be in brackets after the player's name at the centre of the programme in Lansdowne Road. And there was only two Irish clubs represented. I think Blackrock and maybe Gary Owen. So it just, everybody else was from an English club. There was a time when Brian Ashton, as I say, when he was coach, when he put forward a scenario where Ireland would train in the UK because everybody was, at the time, we were flying players in, I remember, into the Aer Lingus grounds. You might know them there just off the airport. So people
ALSA,
that's exactly where it was. I was trying to remember the name. So the players would literally fly into Dublin Airport in the morning. We train in the ALSA grounds, and then they'd all leave in the evening. I mean, it was a disastrous scenario. You never got a chance to kind of sit down, work with the players, and they were almost as if national squad training was being fitted in around the demands of the clubs in London Irish and Harlequins and this. So it was a complete disaster. But I mean, I think both Warren and I remember Billy Lavery was one of the top men in the RFU committee, a solicitor from the north, a fantastic man. He was the first guy who put the actual professional contracts together. And I think they based the contracts on professional cricket contracts in the UK. So that was the founding, that was the starting point. But in conjunction with Billy and the committee, Warren and I made it. We felt the way forward was to get the players back from the UK. And that started around 98, 99. The Mallow Kellys of this world, the Jeremy Davids and all these fellas who were playing with London Irish. David Corkery was in Bristol. Woody had gone to Harlequins. And if you remember, Wes, he actually came back for a season in the build-up to the World Cup and played with Munster, was part of the team in 2000 when they got to the final. So getting the players back meant also that the provinces were going to be more competitive because obviously the better players were now coming back and playing for the provinces. Ulster winning the Heineken Cup or the European Cup as it was in 99. Munster making the final in 2000. In fact, I remember Munster beating Saracens in Vicarage Road in Christmas 99 after we'd lost in the World Cup. And Munster had a fantastic win.
Huge game.
That was the turning point in terms of obviously selection and that and what was to follow afterwards. So, I mean, different times. It's difficult for people looking back to appreciate. I mean, the results were shocking, but there were reasons for it. There was a lot of very good players, but the whole structure and the organisation around the team was all over the place. It was really only when the players came back to Ireland, played with the provinces, then started getting more and more professional players, that the grassroots and the foundation stones were put in for the benefit of the national team.
Sure, it's fascinating, and I'd love to, like, that Saracens 15 would be something to watch as well, but we'd get off the point in a way, because if you look, it's not a spoiler alert, because everyone knows the game we're discussing is Scotland, Ireland-Scotland in the 2006 Nations. The next game in the Six Nations was the one that everyone remembers, which was the O'Driscoll hat-trick game. Was it the next game or the second next game? It was the next game,
game. No. We had Italy at home, and I'll talk about
that. Oh, we got 60 on them, yeah.
Yeah.
But to go back to the previous game, so we were beaten by England. Well, Wes mentioned it earlier. They put 50 on Ireland. So what you're saying, I accept that the structures were coming into place there and the players were beginning to get familiarised with the whole professionalism. But was there a kind of a conscious decision after that to throw in the Rog and the Stringers and Shane Horgan, all of whom made their debut, didn't they?
Yeah, there was. Well, you see, they would have all, well, certainly Rog, John Hayes, Peter Stringer, they would have been all under consideration for the World Cup. But it's like everything else. The World Cup was on in September. So you base a lot of your decisions on what happened, say, in the January to May period before that. Those younger players were all knocking on the door. But were you going to sort of bring them in to start in a World Cup? No, you weren't. I remember Rog was... Well, he was the third choice, number 10 at the time, but we went with two 10s. We had Eric Elwood and David Humphreys played in the World Cup. They had the experience that he didn't have. But a lot of those, John Hayes was another. And they sort of missed out on selection by a very fine margin. Obviously, then, after Lens and the fallout from that, the first game we had in the Six Nations, it was the first year, I think, of the Six Nations Championship. Italy now were officially involved. England away in Twickenham. Then wasn't the place, if you like, to integrate all these young players. In fact, I remember Rog would probably have started, but he injured his knee about 2 weeks before the game and he was touch and go. And we took the decision that, look, going into Twickenham, your first cap, you have a dodgy knee. This isn't the place to play. Peter Stringer, I remember, was on the bench against England that day in Twickenham. But again, England were an outstanding. That was the team, if you like, who were very much, they were dominating the Six Nations. The vast majority of that team went on to win the World Cup in 2003. But we did bring back people like Anthony Foley. Mick Galloway, I remember, was on the bench. So we as I mentioned, Ronan O'Gara would have played. So they were all touch and go. Obviously, then when we lost that game, I remember Warren was sort of really contemplating stepping down. In fact, he had said if we'd lost to Scotland, he was going to step down. And I had told him privately, look, if he was going, I would support him and I would step down with him. So basically, we were ready to make changes. The time was right to make changes. I remember we came back and we were training. In those days, we were based down in Greystones. We used to stay in the Glenview in Wicklow, train in Greystones. But we had a couple of training sessions on the Monday and Tuesday early that week where we made it absolutely clear, lads, you're playing for places in this team. And, I remember the Monday one was a brutal one. People were beating the shit out of each other. And it was no holds barred, which was great. And but the willingness was there to sit down. Raj was always going to come in. We felt it was right for Peter Stringer to start and for John Hayes. To be fair to Eddie, I think the one, the left field one was probably Shane Horgan, in that he had played all his rugby in the centre with Leinster at that stage with Brian O'Driscoll. But Eddie felt, to be fair, that he could do a role on the wing. So we discussed it early in the week, and I remember taking Shane aside in one of the early, after one of the early sessions, I think we went away, we had a coffee, and I remember saying, look, Shane, we're thinking of playing you on the wing on Saturday. And if his reaction was anyway iffy, then we might consider it differently. But immediately he said, absolutely. He said, I'd love to go on the wing. I think I could perform on the wing. So that was it. I mean, he was totally and utterly positive. And when you look at it, he turned out to be a 10 times better winger than he ever was in the centre. So that was an inspired move. And Simon Easterby was the other. He was the fifth, the one of the famous five, if you like. He came in. He would have been involved in the Ireland A side earlier on that season. Was playing in with Leeds, I think, at the time in the Premiership. So and Eddie would have had him on an under 20 side as well. So he knew he was there. So that was the last bit of the jigsaw. Training was really competitive that week, and we said, look. It's shit or bust, basically. We got to go with it. So we made the changes, and that was it.
And listen, Wes, the game didn't start too well. I was looking back on it there, and, I mean, it's incredible. It's great fun to look back. It's on YouTube, and obviously, 10-0 down. It's the Kenny Logan era for Scotland. Obviously, Gregor Townsend playing. 10-0 down, it looked like we were going back to the usual old stuff, really. It was like, it did look like people used to go to rugby matches expecting a beating as supporters as well.
It was a beautiful pass by Gregor Townsend to set up the first Scottish try, kind of looped it over someone's head, put Logan away out in the corner. I was looking back at it last night, but yeah, it's interesting listening to Donal talk about it, because I suppose the way we look back at it is that there was kind of, you know, let's go for broke, as you say, shit or bust with the youth. But as well as going for these young players, there was also, as you mentioned, kind of an embracing of some players that had been out of favour, like Galway, like Foley, like Peter Clossy moving to Loosehead, you know, a little bit before that, but copper fastening it now. And the interesting thing for me is that we were saying how poor we'd been in the 90s, yet we'd come off not too far before that, what's now a legendary Lions tour in 97. And three of our four kind of people that made a huge mark on that tour weren't actually in the team when it came around to 2000. Jeremy Davidson was on the bench. Eric Miller had gone by the wayside. Paul Wallace had gone by the wayside. Only Woody was really there. So it was kind of unusual how we arrived at this formula, this particular team. Like Kieran Dawson was starting ahead of David Wallace still at that point, but it worked. And I suppose the millennium, the new players, Italy been in the Six Nations, the Heineken Cup, there was definitely a feeling of something new about the day. And I think really, you know, to come back from that 10-0 down, 43 unanswered points, to put two more wins on the back of it, including obviously Dricko's hat-trick. I mean, we slipped back a bit at the end of the season, but I think it'll always be viewed as the launch pad for Irish rugby becoming something that was, if not feared, certainly respected.
Yeah, and maybe, Donald, this is my head, but I do get the feeling too that until then we'd done it like back to the Ginger McLaughlin try and Kieran Fitzgerald, where's your effing pride? And it had been such a forward-based template for success. We weren't used to putting it through the backs. That was what the French did. And I also think the manner of the victory and the manner of the performance that season suggested we had backs for the first time in a long time. We always had great finishers out wide. But like, there was an awful lot. There was like a big stylistic change that I think suddenly people went, Jesus, they're entertaining as well.
Yeah, well, I think you're probably being slightly unfair to the 85 Triple Crown and Championship winning team. Mick Doyle was the one fella, if you remember, giving a lash, this type of thing. But Ireland had a fantastic backline that time as well. But it was the first time, if you like, that a coach recognised that there was, we're going to play to the strengths of what you have out wide. In those days, you had the likes of Michael Kiernan, Brendan Mullen, Trevor Ringland, Hugo McNeil, Keith Crossan. And, you know, scored outstanding tries. But you're right, by and large, it had always been a forward-oriented game. I think Gatland was very much into playing high tempo. That's the way he wanted to play. Bear in mind, Gatland was only, I think, 35, when you think about it now. So he had just...
Incredible, really.
He had stopped playing only 2 years previously. He was playing for Waikato, winning Ranfurly Shields in New Zealand. And that was the type of rugby that they played down there. But the one thing about Gatland, I, as you both know, I'm a huge admirer, always have been. But he's never, and he's been consistent in this right throughout his time in Wales and even with the Lions. He's never been afraid to make the hard decisions, and he's never been afraid to promote young players. I think as well, you see, you're in a position now where you could judge the players, even the younger players, at a higher standard because of the Heineken Cup. The likes of your Rodgers, Hayes, Peter Stringers, Shane Horgans, they were going to places like Toulouse and, Stade Francais, Harlequins, Leicester Tigers in Vicarage Road, or in Leicester, playing...
Welford, yeah.
In Welford Road, playing against the top quality players in France and England. They were competing well at that level. So that made it easier to select them in the first place. But I think, to be fair, the likes of the experience that the likes of Foley and Galway would have brought to the side was hugely important. Brian O'Driscoll was sort of just beginning to find his feet at international level at that stage. I mean, Warren and I picked Brian O'Driscoll for a tour to Australia in 99 before he played for Leinster. I remember his first test against Australia in the old Ballymore in Brisbane. I will never forget the morning of the match. We went out, as you do, for your bit of line-out. So sorry, it would have been around lunchtime, evening kickoff. We're over in the Botanic Gardens in Brisbane, doing the line-out. O'Driscoll was like a fella tossing the ball up in the air. He was like out for a stroll. He was up against Tim Horn and Jason Little, were in the centre for Australia, probably the best centre combination in the world. But we were beaten by Australia well in the first test. I think we brought it down. We lost by 6 points in the second test in Perth. And I always remember Tim Horn. I would have played against Tim Horn back in, oh God, on the Lions tour in 89. He was a young fella, played one of the provincial games. He played in that famous World Cup quarterfinal in Lansdowne Row that we lost in the last second. But I always remember Horden coming up to me after the game saying, Jesus, who's the new fella, the number 13? He says, I think he's very good. You want to keep sticking with him? So, I mean, he got a fair endorsement from his very first game. But
Was it like... Even the game before against England, the one try we got, he'd made a great break down the touchline and offloaded for the try, as far as I can remember. But so we knew he was good then. But, I mean, was it a case that the first time you looked at him, you kind of thought, this guy's going to go on to be the best player that's ever played for Ireland? Or when did that realisation happen?
Well, you wouldn't have said that, but you knew he was different to the other guys. Again, I remember... We had a squad session in Galway. Again, we were bringing the players back from England. And, it was a shitty day in the west of Ireland, I think, in Galwegians. We had a couple of injuries. We brought two young players in, like, they talk about development players now and all that. We brought in a young fella called Gordon Darcy and another fella, Brian O'Driscoll. At that stage, Darcy was a winger. But I remember we had two injuries. So O'Driscoll slotted in the centre, and Darcy was on the wing when we were training. And Conor O'Shea, who, as we know, has gone on to be an outstanding coach. But even back then, he had a great eye for a player. But Conor came up to me. He was playing with London Irish, so he wouldn't have known any of the young players on the Irish scene. And he came up to me after the session. I want a word with you. He said, Jesus, who was the fella in the centre? He was outstanding. And he wasn't even on the Leinster team at that stage. So he always had something special in him. It was difficult, obviously, to make your mark in his first couple of games. But, you know, once he found his feet in that season in particular in 2000, obviously after the game in Paris, things were never going to be the same again for him. And, you know, he went on to be probably one of our greatest players of all time.
Yeah, and we've talked, obviously, there was the young fellas who made their debut, and we'll get to that in a little while too, in terms of the influence they had in the game, and Shane scoring that try in the corner. I think he dropped it, by the way, looking back, but there was no TMO. I mean, and then Rog nailed this unbelievable touchline conversion, which kind of, I think most people went, wow, this kid, not unlike Brian O'Driscoll, he's a bit special, when we saw just the way that he handled the pressure and his kicking that day, his place kicking. But Dennis Hickey, I mean, he's one we talked about, Golliffe, who's famous for this match, I suppose, Wes, too, because it was the famous still photograph of him with his arms around Peter Stringer and Ronan O'Gara. But Dennis Hickey.
You know the background, before you go on to Dennis Hickey, the background, yeah. Galway was a cute fecker, in terms of he'd been dropped more times at that stage, and everybody was telling him he was too small for the second row. He always tells the story, Noisy Murphy, telling him, you're too small. We have to. Because he had played a bit in the back row as well. But Galway, everybody thinks it's this great, I'm here looking after these two young fellas. He found the two smallest fellas he could for the national anthem, so he'd look like an absolute giant next to them. He's got away with that one for years.
Hasn't he, Josh? Yeah, no, absolutely. But sure, listen, Dennis Hickey, because again, it's always all our consumption of sport, if we're not professional players, is tied up with memories of our own lives. And I remember Dennis Hickey being a minor celebrity for about 2 weeks in 1998 because he had scored a try against France. We came nowhere near beating them. But isn't that true?
You're wrong. 98 is the game I told you we lost by 2 points in the end.
That was 97, was it? I can't remember. He scored a try in Paris. It was 18-16 game. It was definite because I was editing a magazine at the time, and I remember saying, I wonder, could I get him to do a bit of PR for us and we'll go and get a picture of him drinking a beer. He was the only person that would have appealed to a young men audience at the time.
You'd have had no problem getting pictures of any of the other fellas having a beer, I can tell you.
No problem with Dennis either. In fairness, he was a sport. He didn't, again, innocent days, he didn't ask for a penny. He came along and helped out with a picture of a pint in his hand.
Yeah, but going back to that game, that 98 game, as I said, we were expected to be hammered by 40, 50 points. Brian Ashton cried off. Gatlin came in, and you know, I'd only met him once or twice at that stage, but I always remember he said, look, and the biggest problem was the Irish team, they felt unloved, they felt as if, you know, there was no support for all the reasons that you're making out. But Gatlin made an appeal, look, for the Irish public, encouraged them to send text messages, as they were at the time, to support the Irish team. So we're staying out in Versailles, we're out there from the Thursday. Next thing, all these messages start flooding into the IRFU offices from all over the country. So we went out training and on the Friday morning. And when we came back, Warren, in fairness, he had arranged all the messages had been put up on the wall of our team room. So we came in, we're having our grub. Next thing, you're talking about 300 or 400 messages up on the wall. So the players are walking around, they're reading the messages. And bear in mind, as I say, Irish rugby was in a difficult position at the time, but all of a sudden the players felt, Jesus, yes, there is a massive support out there. There is goodwill for them. And we had that game. I remember we lost a bloody line out 5 metres out. They got a try off. We were leading with 2 or 3 minutes to go, lost by 2 points. So, and as you say, Dennis did score that day. Dennis, I always had great time for Dennis Hickey. I always thought he was an outstanding player. But at the end of that year, we went on the tour of South Africa. He got a bad injury. He smashed his face. He was Stefan Terblanche scored 4 tries in his debut opposite Dennis on the wing. Now, obviously, they weren't all Beck and Dennis's fault. But in the second test against South Africa, he smashed his face badly. He was out injured for a while. I think he lost confidence after that. So he missed out in 99, missed out in the World Cup, but he was back for the Six Nations in 2000. He was playing really well for Leinster. Remember, I did a piece in the Examiner recently about that, the 2000 game in Paris. At the unsung heroes in the team, Dennis was one of them. Everybody remembers Dricko's 3 tries, but Dennis Hickey saved the day, if you like. Their hooker, Del Mazza, was about a 30 metres break. He was going to score under the post to take the game away from us. And Dennis tracked back from, must have made 30 metres. But he literally threw himself at the feet of Del Mazza. Now, for a guy who had smashed his face 12 months earlier, to do what he did was incredible. I'm not quite sure how legal or otherwise the tackle would be viewed upon now. Del Mazza spilt the ball. Dricko, in fairness, had covered back as well and touched it down. So that saves the day, because had they scored again at that point in the match, I don't think we'd have got back into it. But I was so happy for Dennis. I remember him going up into the dressing room after the game and just looking at him and saying, Dennis, do you remember how miserable you were in that hospital in Pretoria, having smashed your face? I remember going to the hospital on the Sunday after that test to collect him, to bring him back to the hotel. And he was down for all kinds of reasons. But his bravery at that moment in the game, and I think, you know, we both smiled at each other and had a little hug in the dressing room after the game. So I had huge admiration for Dennis Hickey. And of course, from that moment on in 2000, he went on and he had a great 7 years at international level after that. In fact, I thought retired a bit prematurely, retired after the 07 World Cup, which again was probably a disappointing note to go out on. But he was an outstanding player.
Yeah, I mean, if there's a ghost on the side of the 09 Grand Slam team photo, it's definitely Dennis Hickey. But sure, listen, he doesn't need me to say that. Wes, another thing I noticed looking back in that game, it was the first time I remember, I don't remember it until I saw it back, was Fields of Athenry began to rumble when Ireland got 20-10 up against Scotland. And there was definitely all these little shifts that we can overanalyze now, but there was a sense of something taking off.
It's incredible just talking how many things come back to your head. Like Donal mentioned Noisy Murphy there, who I think was his predecessor, but I remember reading Brendan Fanning's book, his excellent book, From There to Here, kind of tracking, you know, the evolution of Irish rugby in the pro era. And after a fitness test just a couple of years before that, Noisy asked Anthony Foley and Keith Wood, was there fat in the water in Killaloe, because their body mass index was so consistently poor. I also remember probably that season or the season before we beat Scotland, I remember being in the clubhouse in Greenfields after Young Munsters played Dungannon, and it was still kind of a novelty seeing David Humphreys swanning around the clubhouse, because you were still only getting 4 games a year on TV at this point, really, you know. But I remember Gatland was the newly appointed Irish coach, and he came in and he was chatting to Claw. And Claw was stood there with a pint and a fag, chatting away to the Ireland coach. Like, so
hero.
Funny how quickly you had to appear professional. You certainly didn't have to 6 months before it anyway. But
no, look, there was a good bit of character around that side. There was a great mix of the old and the young. You know, you had fellas like Paddy Johns, who was the head captain of the side in South Africa, because Woody wasn't really going to go on the tour in 98 after the Lions tour the previous season, but we had a run of injuries with hookers, so therefore he agreed to come out, and he sort of played in the latter half of the tour. He played in the test series, so Paddy Johns was captain in Woody's absence. He was on the bench. You mentioned Jeremy Davidson. I mean, Jeremy Davidson was the star of the Lions in 97, but he had a horrific knee injury, and that set him back. So he was out of the scene for about a year and a half, recovering from that injury. Paul Wallace had been tighted, but, you know, he was... John Hayes was the coming guy by the time we got around to 2000, and Claw, of course, being the survivor that he was. Claw worked out after 97 that Paul Wallace was going to be tight head for a long time. So I had a conversation with him. In fact, I remember bringing Des Fitzgerald, who I would have played with, who played tight end and loose head with Ireland, Luke Fitzgerald's dad. I brought him into Greystones before we left for the tour of South Africa. And I said to Des, look, we think Peter Clancy could play loose head. So Desi had a crash course in a claw as a loose head in Greystones. I always remember we played the first match on tour. Reggie Corrigan was the starting loose head, and Claw was playing tight head. We played Bulland, and Reggie Corrigan got a horrific kick in the back. At this stage, Brian O'Brien, who went on to succeed me as manager with Ireland, he was a Shannon manager. Shannon were pulling up trees in the All-Ireland League. They were winning them for fun in those days. Hayes was on the side, but Brian O told me that Hayes could play tight head and loose head. So anyway, we took a punt and we brought him to South Africa. We were in the dressing room at halftime, and Reggie Corrigan was ruled out. So I said to Hayes, you're coming in, you're playing loose head. And Hayes said to me, I never played loose head in my life. So then Claw was tight head in that game. So I said to Claw, come here. I said, do you remember the squad session? Yeah, he says, look, you're going to have to get in loose head because Hayes is coming on at tight head. I said, remember everything Desi told you. Tuck in your elbow. Do everything that he... don't worry about me, says Claw. I'll be fine. And that was the start of Claw playing loose head. And he got another 5 years out of professional rugby, which he might never have got but for that decision to change and to play loose head. And I remember we were playing South Africa in the test series, and we knew South Africa would know that Peter was a tight head. We said, look, we can't start him at loose head because they go after him straight away. So Justin Fitzpatrick came in, and actually he got his first caps in that series and did very well. But Claw, we had the two peacemakers, Claw and Trevor Brennan, coming off the bench in probably two of the most volatile test matches you ever saw in your life as the peacemakers. But that's how Claw ended up at loose head. So it's amazing, really.
Pacemakers is probably more apt.
But Claw, you see, Claw was a great footballer. And, you know, while he never looked the fittest, he was actually a brilliant athlete. It was funny, I was looking back at the 2000 game, the Drico one, coming up after the Scotland match. And I did an article, as I said, a couple of weeks ago on it. But Claw was involved in the build-up to two or three tries. He had brilliant, carrying brilliantly well. He had great hands. He played in the back row as a young fella. So he was a very good footballer that people probably didn't appreciate.
He missed a bit of time with injury and for other reasons as well, obviously, so we won't get into it. But is he a guy that you look at and say, if he'd have been starting his career in 2000, fully professional, like, just how good could he have gone on to be, maybe?
Well, I put it this way to you. You know, you're alluding to the fact he missed a bit of time due to suspensions. But he went to Australia. People forget he played Super Rugby with the Queensland Reds. And I was actually a selector with the 97 Lions team that went to South Africa. And I had played with Claw for Munster in his early years. So so I always had time for him. And I kept in contact with him when he was in Queensland. And I kept putting his name on the table for selection and saying, look, lads, this guy is playing Super Rugby. You're going to South Africa. He has knowledge of playing against the South African teams. And, I remember Fran Cotton was the manager. And Fran, who was obviously a fantastic tight head himself, he had contacts in Australia. So he kept an eye on Claw there. Claw was actually selected for the Lions tour. I mean, Paul Wallace ended up getting on the test team, but Claw came back and failed a fitness test with his back. He had a bad back in those days. Unluckily for him, he actually was part of the Lions when they assembled for that 97 tour, but he failed a fitness test and was sent home. Paul Wallace was going on that dreaded development tour that I mentioned earlier to New Zealand, and he was called in at the last minute as a reserve for Claw. And he ends up playing in all three tests in a historic test series.
Just looking here, Donal, at the bench the day of the Scotland game, and it was Rob Henderson, David Humphreys, Jeremy Davidson, Justin Fitzpatrick. And I'm just wondering, I can't quite remember exactly when it happened, but was it right around that time that selectors and the public, I suppose, in general, started to recognise the value of impact off the bench? And were you starting to select teams and benches on that basis?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, people, you'll remember, but for the younger generation, I mean, there was a time you could be a sub for Ireland and somebody had to die on the field before you got a chance of coming off the bench to come
in. Look at Gatti's career himself with New Zealand.
Yeah, I think he's over 20-something times sitting on the bench behind Sean Fitzpatrick. Yeah. Sean Fitzpatrick never came off once in those games. Gatti actually never got a test cap for New Zealand. But, yeah, I mean, I suppose rugby coaches were coming to terms with the whole thing about impact subs and making changes because, and it changed the way that you approach selection as well, because it gave you an option. In other words, you could have a punt off a young player like Ronan O'Gara in the knowledge that if things weren't going well, you can bring in a David Humphreys or an Eric Elwood off the bench. So that impacted on selection. But I think also it became an art. Like I was brought up in a GA background, so I was always kind of used to a scenario where subs were brought into games and all that. But people who were in rugby all their lives, which is a kind of an alien concept, that you're picking somebody who might be able to come in and change the course of a game in the last 20 minutes. So, yeah.
But wasn't there even a tradition? I don't know, was it my imagination again, but things like maybe schools cups or something, that it was only the 15 lads got a medal, or anyone who'd been on the pitch, and that often meant subs didn't even get medals. It was ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly the way it was. So, I mean, it was, and then it became to a stage where you had five subs on the bench. You could only make two substitutions, regardless. I remember we played France. We played France in 1985 in Dublin, the year we won the championship. We won a triple crown. We drew 15 all with France. Yeah. But we lost two. We lost Brian Spillane and Philip Matthews in the first 15, 20 minutes. We ended up having a prop playing in the back row. But you couldn't bring on another sub. If you had a third injury, that was just tough luck. You had to play about 14 players. So it's in fact, look, this is a debate for another day. But I've been preaching for years about we now have too many substitutions. And it's changed the way rugby is played by virtue of the fact now that you have a 6-2 split on the bench, for argument's sake. So you're replacing three quarters of your forwards. That's changed the whole concept of the way the game is played. I've been arguing for years that we have far too many subs. The better teams would nearly always win out in the last 20 minutes because of the fact that you weren't able to bring in fresh legs and certainly not bring in 22-stone prop forwards who can only play rugby for 25 minutes of a game, and that's their aerobic capacity. So, but look, again, another debate for another day.
I absolutely, and a very interesting one, because you could say that, like, a mediocre player, and that's wrong, I mean, like an average test standard player who would be an amazing player at full 100% oxygen compared to a better test player at 90% oxygen. Like, I mean, there is a kind of a problem there, isn't it? You have inferior players playing better because of the physical demands of the 80 minutes.
Absolutely. And in fact, even it was brought home to me there about 2 years ago. We had an injury crisis in Cannes for the All-Ireland League. And we had a young lad. We were down to a young player, Gordon Good, who came. He was out of Christians his first year. And we were playing Lansdowne in the All-Ireland League. He was the only fit hooker in the club. He played. And he played 80 minutes. Now, the young fella had to be dragged off the field afterwards. But he told me afterwards, about an hour after the game, by the time he got the oxygen back, it was the first time in his whole life that he played 80 minutes in rugby. Wow. So he'd come through a school's career in Christians. He never in his life had played a full game of rugby. I mean, it's amazing.
Axel actually said it to me, God rest him, a few years back, that when concussion was at its height in the news and the safety of the game was kind of being constantly debated, he said that he felt the way replacement rules had changed over the years was adding massively to the danger of the game because you weren't letting fatigue take its natural course. Yeah. And that would have been what would temper down those hits ultimately.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you go back to, famous game France against Ireland in Dublin. I remember Brian O'Driscoll had to make a huge hit. Can't remember the big tight head from Claremont. Can't remember his name. It was about 22-stone. Came on with 15 minutes to go. Brian O'Driscoll is out on his feet, as brave as always. He made the tackle, but your man Polak's him. Do you know what I mean? You wouldn't have that type of players coming in if you didn't have the facility to change six of your pack.
Wes?
Just on that bench thing then, Donal, I suppose the one that comes to mind from that game and that time is, you know, Rog and Humphreys. And it took on a similar dynamic to Rog had with Sexton in reverse later in his career. But do you ever think, because of the kind of stories career Rog went on to have and all the last gas dramatics and that, that maybe David Humphreys sometimes is an underrated player in the public memory?
Yes, I do. I think Humphreys was an outstanding player. And look, he's gone on, as we know, he's director of rugby in Ulster. He's still director of rugby in Gloucester. He had a brilliant brain. And in fact, you know, go back again to the game that we're talking about against Scotland. And quite rightly, you highlighted Rodgers kicking that day. But I remember 10 minutes into the second half, Rodgers was struggling. We needed a bit of impetus. I remember speaking to Gatti, we need to make a change. We have to bring in Humphreys, which we did. So Humphreys came in and played the last 30 minutes of that game.
But scored a try, kicked all his kicks. He pound for pound, he had as good, if not better, a game than Rog. It's just remembered because it was the Rog debut, I guess.
Yeah, and he also came in off the bench. He got the kick against France that we needed in the last minute of that game in 2000 came off. But I tell you where he was brilliant in those days. He had a coach's mindset about him. So he was brilliant sitting in the stand, analysing the game. He could see where the space was. He could see. It was almost as if you're given a sort of an image of what's happening in a game before you play the game. So he was able to sit on the bench for 40 or 50 minutes, analyse what was happening, and utilise his opportunity when he came on the field to make, even in some cases, a bigger impact than he might have made had he started in the game.
Yeah, sorry, but it something struck me because Wes said about was Humphreys underrated. I don't know the man, and I'd know only Rog a bit, you'd know him well, and Rog never would underrate himself, and that's part of his magic. But did Humphreys underrate himself a little bit? Did it take him a while to cop that he was test quality in his own brain?
Yeah, I think it did. Certainly, again, I remember he had a running battle with Eric Elwood in the years prior to Rog coming on the scene, and he had this fixation. I remember having to put his arm around him on a tour in Australia in 99. And he had this fixation that Eric Elwood, because he was from Galwegians, that he was Gatland's choice and all that. But look, that wasn't the case. And Humps was the guy that you had to put your arm around and reinforce the fact how good a player he was. You saw that probably more with Ulster because he was the king in Ulster. He was the Raj. Yeah. He was to Ulster what Raj was for Munster. But, you know, there were times. I mean, I put it this way to you. I think he was very unlucky not to become a Lion, not to go on a Lions tour. He was a really good player and he's proved out to be a very good administrator and coach.
Donald, just, I suppose, without wanting to veer into controversy, and I know the people involved too well to get into that, but it'd be remiss not to mention that Eddie O'Sullivan had come on board just before this game. And, you know, I suppose at the time he was very much thought of as a kind of expert in back play.
You been listening, Wes? We've been giving Eddie his due here all along.
Well, I wonder what was his impact on that slight change in style and approach maybe in the amongst the backs particularly.
To be fair, I think he had a big impact. I think it was something that was coming. I mean, Philip Danner had worked very well with that particular group. It was almost as if confidence had taken off. Eddie had a very good vision as to how he wanted to play. I remember there was issues between Eddie and Warren, a lot of it surrounded, I think, the way that you approach, the way you defend. Warren had one idea, Eddie had another, but Warren was the boss. But certainly in terms of attack, I think Eddie, without question, brought a freshness to that. But look, I think it's probably a bit too much to, we were only two or three games into Eddie's time as assistant coach by the time we'd played France, so you'd have to feel that it was coming. But then again, I think, look, circumstances, fellas like O'Driscoll were presented with opportunities. I mean, a lot of those tries, there was a real individualistic mark about certainly two of O'Driscoll's three tries. But there's no question that Eddie had a huge impact in terms of the way the backs played. And I mean, Eddie was an outstanding coach, went on to have a stellar career with Ireland as coach. Unfortunately, I think soured, and people only remember the 2007 World Cup, which is a pity, because for two or three years there, Ireland played outstanding rugby and Eddie was very much to the fore of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And listen, we all hurt Eddie more than anyone else about the 2007 Croke Park game against France, which was a game we were never going to win and then looked like we couldn't lose. But we won't go over those old grounds. Now, just a couple more memories to wrap that up. David Humphreys absolutely hoofed the ball into Havelock Square at the end. There was such a relief and a feeling of we've done something here. And the way Lansdowne Road rose that day, it hadn't done in many years. There was a sense we've actually beaten a team we haven't beaten 12 years. We've hockeyed them, because remember, Scotland got two late tries after it was 44-10. This was something new, something fresh.
Yeah, it was. And to be fair, like you mentioned, we hadn't won, which is incredible when you think about it. I was actually captain of the previous Irish team that beat Scotland in 88.
And that says it all.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? But I, you know, as I'd said, Warren Gatland, if we lost the game, Warren was going to step down. And as you said, we were 10 points down. And I've just finished reading Warren's book over the lockdown period. And, you know, he refers to this match in the book and, you know, the fact that that he was going to step down. And look, if he did, I was going to go with him. So you can imagine the relief on his face after that game. I remember at the time, I think there were some renovations in Lansdowne Road. In the old days, you used to go in under the stand. The post-match reception was there, but they had this big marquee out in the car park at the back, and all the families and the wives, and you'd swear we'd won the World Cup. The sense of relief and the atmosphere there after the game was just incredible. I remember meeting Roger's dad, Fergal, who I would have known reasonably well, and you know, he was obviously emotional, his son getting his first cap. And then he was thinking, oh God, he was taken off 10 minutes into the second half. And I was, Jesus, don't look at it that way. I mean, he had an outstanding debut. It was very much a squad effort on the day. And, you know, Raj and Humps would go on and have an incredible jostle right for a number of years afterwards, not least the 03 World Cup in Australia, when they sort of both shared some good moments and some not so good moments. So, you know, but the relief afterwards was incredible. But I do remember you're talking about the Italy game was in the middle of one. And like, I was around a long time to know that Italy had given Ireland a lot of hassle in the years prior to that game. Mm-hmm. And I remember on the Thursday before the Italian game, you're beating Scotland so well. Everybody was in a high. And I thought it was, Jesus, I mean, how could Ireland be complacent about playing anyone? But I remember reading the Riot Act on a Friday morning before we went training, thinking, who do you think you are? We won one game. If we turn around and don't perform against Italy, you can forget it. And, you know, we went out, I think, was it you said we put 60 points in Italy?
60-15, yeah.
Yeah, and then the France game was the next game. So, I mean, geez, like beating France in Paris. Remember Tommy Kiernan coming down from the stand after we beat France in Paris? Ireland hadn't won in France, I think, since 72. You're dead right. And that was in the old Stade Cologne, I think.
Yeah.
But remember
Tommy Kiernan
coming down. And just, I was doing an interview on RTE, as you do after the games. But he just came over, shook my hand, gave a thumbs up, and he left. He flew home straight away. Didn't even go to the post-match reception. So, I mean, that's what it meant to a lot of people who'd been sort of working and foraging away in the background, because, you know, there were tough times in Irish rugby, but there's no question. You had the perfect synergy. You had the rise of the provinces through the Heineken Cup. You had the players all coming back from the UK and now playing with their provinces. You had these young lads all came through at the same. I mean, Woody was an outstanding player before the likes of Raj, and he's kind of been forgotten about to some degree with the likes of, you know, and the O'Garas, the Paul O'Connells, the Brian O'Driscolls, Darcy Horgan, all these guys came through. But Woody was kind of ploughing a lone furrow there for a long time. Outstanding yeah. on the Lions Tour in 97 and indeed in 2001.
But you know, it's the word professional, Donal, isn't it? It can mean, sometimes it can mean the wrong thing, or it can be interpreted the wrong way. But Keith Wood, I'd absolutely agree. He kind of democratized the notion of being a professional rugby player, that it was something that was available to people if they worked hard at. And the next generation after that became model pros. And I think it widened the appeal of rugby because it's much easier to get behind a fellow who does it for a living in many ways.
Yeah, no, and but I also think Woody was a groundbreaker. You know, he wasn't lacking in confidence, but I mean, it's one thing to walk the walk. He always talked the talk. He always performed, you know, in Irish teams where they weren't quite as good as that team that came along in the mid-noughties. But, you know, you must remember Keith Wood went to the World Cup in 95, smashed his shoulder against Japan. He was out of the game for a year. But rather than try to relaunch himself with Munster or with Gary Owen, he went off and went to Harlequins, and he hadn't played rugby for a year. So, I mean, he did things the hard way. He went over and proved himself over there, ended up as a consequence of that, getting on that Lions tour in 97 and was one of the stars of the show. So, you know, I always think he was the guy who led the way in many ways for a lot of the other younger players coming through. And, you know, there's no doubt the likes of O'Gara and O'Driscoll would have looked up to him very much so when they were coming through as young players learning their trade.
Mm-hmm. And Wes, I mean, it's Ireland was changing too. That's the other thing. Like, you mentioned the kind of corporate I suppose a PR stunt, but a very good one in fairness, of the text messages in 98. Then I just remembered, I'd forgotten this, somebody said they'd give $1 million if anyone scored 4 tries in the match against Wales after the hat-trick, the Drico hat-trick match. And of course, Wales won a game they shouldn't have won. That was back to your thing, Donald, that maybe they certainly didn't get complacent after the Scottish match, but after the French match, there was that little dip. But the season was over and we had 3 wins in the bag, which almost doubled our tally in the previous 5 years.
Well, we'd have shared the championship with England had we won, had we beaten Wales. I think we lost 23-19. That was my last match involved with that because I was going on to step down to be involved with the Lions the following year. But it was a huge disappointment that we lost that match. Shouldn't have lost it. But look, again, it was part of the process in terms of finding our feet. But look, I think there's no question from 2000 onwards, things got better and better. So it was definitely the launch pad for what was to come.
Great season, Wes.
Yeah, brilliant. I suppose just mentioning your someone offering however much money for 4 tries. Axel got 3 tries against Biarritz and Thomond Park not long after. All he got was pizza for life out of it. So the money hadn't filtered down to the provinces quite yet at that point. But no, I think there. I think, like you say, the crowd got into it. I think there was representatives from the 4 provinces. I think Axel, Golliv, Claw, Foley gave a kind of a everyman feel to the team, maybe that hadn't been there a few years previously. I remember Definitely. Mike Mullen, who was a New Zealander, but his grandmother grew up just around the corner from where I grew up. And Mike Mullins, John Gallagher, who won a World Cup with the All Blacks, and Matt Williams, his grandparents, all grew up on the one street in this tiny council estate in Limerick, was another little cling we had to the team at the time. So, yeah, I think it was tempting to look at it as the start of a journey that culminated with the Grand Slam in 09. But in reality, as Donald says, it was probably more like the midpoint of the journey, and a lot had actually gone into place before that to facilitate that happening. So, yeah, seminal day, I think, for sure, in Irish rugby in the pro era, without doubt.
Lads, it's a great pleasure talking to you, so take care. And anyone tuning in, it's been a pleasure to be able to bring you any bit of old content, as they call it these days. So take care of yourselves out there as well. But thanks to Wes Liddy and Donal Lennon, and hopefully we'll chat again soon, boys.
Thanks very much.
Cheers. Thanks, lads. Stay safe.